Sorry, give me 1 second. Okay. Welcome everyone, welcome to our home. Nice to post something here, now that we've renovated a little bit. And welcome to the series. Welcome to those who, well, you say you've been following me, but nice to meet you in person. So someone I was talking to said to me, what does it mean Kabbalah breathing? I didn't know that there was Kabbalah, had anything to say about a person's breathing, but of course, Kabbalah has a lot to say on breathing. But what I thought what I'd do is I'll just spend a few minutes, first of all, before we get into this topic, just to talk about Kabbalah in general. I think it's an important thing to understand. What is Kabbalah? In fact, let me ask you, when you say Kabbalah, what do you think it is?
Mysticism.
Okay, so now tell me what mysticism is.
Spirituality.
All right, the spiritual side of things, yeah, correct. Any other definition?
A way of explaining the unexplainable.
Not a bad definition, actually. All right, so let me just share with you, because I want to just sort of define it a bit from a Jewish point of view, because there's lots of, I mean, Kabbalah is sort of a very thrown around word these days, and a lot of pop Kabbalah going on, and sort of a lot of, you know, different kinds of Kabbalah, and but from a Jewish point of view, what is it, right? So there's a concept in Kabbalah, actually, called pardes. If you ever look at the handout, there's a word in Hebrew called pardes, which means orchard, garden, a garden, a place where things grow. And often Kabbalah is referred to in the Talmud as pardes, exploring the garden, taking a walk in the garden. But it's interesting because really Kabbalah is only a part of that garden. The reason why I say that is because the commentaries tell us, the mystics tell us, the Talmud tells us that the Torah, Jewish learning, is actually divided into four parts, which is hinted in the word pardes, right? So if you have a look, if you know about Hebrew, you see the word pardes is pei resh dalet samach, and it's made up as an acronym of four different words. The first is the pei is pshat, which means the simple meaning of what we learn. So Torah tells us stories, gives us various mitzvot, and so on. So it's just a very simple meaning, literal meaning, the pshat, as they say, of what we talk about. Remez is the things that it alludes to, everything we learn always has connections, references to other things, sort of interconnecting different concepts and hints that we find in the various types of learning. Then we have drush, which is the interpretation which is normally beyond the literal meaning. So for example, the Talmud is full of medrash, meaning medrash either in the philosophical sense or in the halachic sense, where we take verses of the Torah and we explain them on a bit of a deeper level, in a more sort of not looking a little bit deeper, not the literal meaning, but what it's representing, what it symbolizes, what it's alluding to, what it's trying to teach us, the extra letters, the extra nuances, and so on and so forth. And then the final one is the samach, which is called sod, which is secret, right? Which means the esoteric, the Kabbalah, the mystical side of things. Now, the reason why this is important, because from a Jewish point of view, one doesn't really work without the other. In other words, every part, it's said about the Arizal. The Arizal was one of the 16th century great Kabbalists, one of the greatest Kabbalists. In fact, much of what we talk about today in Kabbalah is based on the teachings of the Arizal. He was the mystic who lived in Tzfat, among other mystics who lived there as well during the 16th century. And as I'll soon explain, there was a turning point in the teachings of Kabbalah where he sort of started to disseminate Kabbalah in a much bigger way than it was before. But it's told about the Arizal that he would, every day he would study a lot, not just Kabbalah, he would study all parts of the Torah. And he would study the Talmud. And what he would do is, Talmud is a very complex analysis of Jewish law and so on. And every day the Arizal would study the Talmud from a halachic perspective. And then when it came Shabbat, being the mystical day of the week, the day of holiness, the day of spirituality, he would take the very same page of the Talmud and understand it Kabbalistically. He would learn it according to the Kabbalistic interpretation, right? And the concept behind that was because they go together. Every part of the Torah is subdivided into these four, which then fragments into many others, but that's the four basic components of Jewish learning, all true, just expressed and manifested on different levels. And the point behind that is that one doesn't really work without the other. It's like a garden. That's why it's called garden, right? So if you go into a garden and you pick off a beautiful looking flower, the flower looks beautiful and you want to take it home with you, without being rooted in the garden and being in a nurturing environment. Here we are. Right, without being rooted in the garden, without being in its natural habitat, in a sort of nurturing environment, the flower eventually will actually wither, right? It'll wither and it will die. And the reason is because what Kabbalah did for us is, as you said before, Kabbalah exposed us to an amazingly spiritual form of learning, a mystical form of learning. It took us and transported us into higher worlds, into mystical worlds, into secrets that we weren't otherwise privy to. But the point was not to detach us from reality. The point was to lift us up within the reality. And that's why Jewish learning has this combination of being very spiritualized through the study of Kabbalah, but being grounded through the study of the other parts of Jewish wisdom. And you can't really divorce the two. That doesn't mean one has to observe all the mitzvot or to study Kabbalah, but it does mean that in terms of its teachings, they're all interconnected, right? So really, the more sort of literal meaning, or the halachic, or the Talmudic part of Jewish wisdom, that's the body of Jewish learning, and Kabbalah is the soul of Jewish learning, and they kind of go together. So just to give you a very quick summary of what Kabbalah does, what its purpose is, and also the development of Kabbalah. So,
sorry, Rabbi,
yes, sure, please ask.
So, are you saying that in order to study Kabbalah, you actually can't do it in isolation? It's part
of a general Jewish, authentic Kabbalah. Yeah.
Yeah. Kabbalah is part of knowing the Torah, and then it's an enhancement on that.
Now that doesn't mean if you're not versed in the whole Torah, you can't study Kabbalah. It does mean that really, it's got more to do with the person who teaches Kabbalah. In other words, the person who teaches Kabbalah cannot be someone who only teaches Kabbalah. It's going to be someone that connects it to other parts of Jewish learning as well. Otherwise, it misses its actually purpose, right? Because it's interesting to understand the word Kabbalah. It's very interesting, actually. Before we refer to Kabbalah as sod, the secret, right? But actually, that's not what Kabbalah means. You're a Hebrew teacher, aren't you? No? Right? The word Kabbalah means lekabel, to receive. Right? To receive. And how's that different from other parts of the Torah? Because what it does is, Kabbalah being the deepest part of the Torah, its purpose actually is to surrender to something higher than us, right? And to actually let go of our own egocentricity, and to, I suppose the bad term used to use is to lose ourselves, but that's one way of saying it, but it's actually to discover our real self, which is actually something higher within us, the godly part of ourselves, right? So it's not just to, see, people talk about becoming spiritual. It's interesting. Pursuing spirituality, I mean, it wasn't the topic of tonight, but I'm very passionate about this topic, so I'll just throw it in there, right? Becoming spiritual, sometimes people say, you know, I don't like the mundane, I don't want to be materialistic, so I want to become spiritual, right? But the truth is that often what people mean by becoming spiritual, it's a pursuit which is quite similar to material pursuit. It's just a different type of pursuit, you know. Some people like chocolate, people like, I don't know, something more healthy. Right? But it's still what they want. In other words, it's really themselves. So you can study Kabbalah and you can pursue spirituality, but never lose your ego, never lose who you are, never strive for something higher, right? Kabbalah is actually the opposite. Kabbalah is obviously it's about spirituality, it's about exploring spirituality, it's about delving into deeper spiritual concepts, but it's actually about Kabbalah. It's about receiving from something higher. It's something we can't work out on ourselves, we can't interpret it on our own, we've got to receive it, it's been handed down from generation to generation. And of course, the tradition of Jewish Kabbalah is that it's rooted, as the rest of Torah is, in the revelation of Mount Sinai, right? Now, interesting, when God gave us the Torah, different parts of the Torah have been revealed in different generations, and of course, it's a separate shiur, a separate discussion to understand the exact evolution of Kabbalah, but very briefly, around the year 200, roughly, there was the great Talmudic sage called Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and he was the author of the Zohar, which the Zohar is really the seminal work of Kabbalah, right? Much of what we talk about is based on the Zohar. There were works of Kabbalah before, there were Kabbalists before Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, but it was very under wraps, very secret. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was the first to author and to disseminate and to reveal Kabbalah to a very select few, by the way. Not, it wasn't very public, but still revelation nonetheless, right? And in the Tzar, the Kabbalah is very factual. In fact, that's real Kabbalah. What I mean to say is, it's like facts. So the Tzar will just teach us and instruct us about what takes place on the various supernal worlds. You know, there's the four worlds of Atzilut, Briah, Yetzirah, Asiyah. There's the Ein Sof, as the Kabbalah often refers to it, the infinite light of God. There's different worlds, different angels, and different palaces and parlors and stuff like that that take place in all the different mystical worlds. The Zohar will go through what that means. The Zohar will talk about the soul. The Zohar will tell us what happens with the soul before it's born, after it dies. The Zohar will tell us there's millions of facts in the Zohar exposing us to these deep spiritual ideas. So that was Kabbalah then. The Zohar, in fact, was not revealed right away. It was revealed much later, but it was authored in about the year 200 by Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. He was a tremendous Kabbalist. He's buried in Meiron. Lag BaOmer is the famous day that we celebrate his passing. And COVID permitting, next Lag BaOmer, there'll be thousands and thousands of people, as there was 2 years ago. Not last year, but it's an amazing crowd there, every Lag BaOmer. Where Kabbalah took a whole nother state is in the time of the Arizal, which was the Kabbalists of the 16th century. At that time, Tzfat, which till today, Tzfat is a very mystical city, if you've ever been there, very artistic city, it's a very spiritual city on all levels. And the 16th century Kabbalist, led by the Arizal, Moshe Kadavira before him, but mainly by the Arizal, started to expand Kabbalah. In fact, the Arizal was the one to say that the time has come to start teaching Kabbalah, to spreading Kabbalah. What he meant was different than what we mean today. What he meant was that means to still a select few, but he started to establish yeshivot, academies to teach Kabbalah, and the Arizal and his colleagues started to give Kabbalah more meaning, more understanding. So they would explain the facts of the Zohar to reflect what does that mean? How does that explain to us how the world is created? The Arizal, for example, one of the great emphasis of the Arizal was the Sfirot. The Sfirot are the 10 powers of creation, starting from Keter, Chochmah, Bina, Chesed, and Gevurah, and so on. Not today's topic, but Sfirot are very, very commonly spoken about in Kabbalah. It's the tools that God used to reveal the Ein Sof, to reveal the infinite light of God, to ultimately create the world. It gives the world a lot more meaning. It sort of conceptually connects every part of the world to a godly force. So, for example, water is connected to the Sefira of Chesed, kindness, fire is the Sefira of Gvura, and so on. So it kind of creates that connection and it gave it much more meaning. But still, an exploration, lifting up the person, giving the person the opportunity to explore that which is greater, that which is transcendent, that which is secretive, that which is mystical. And then I would say the third part of the sort of the turning point of the Kabbalah was the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov with the founding of Hasidut, right? So Hasidut is also esoteric part of Torah. So Hasidut is based on Kabbalah, but Hasidut is very, very much turning Kabbalah the opposite direction. In other words, Kabbalah lifts us up to see what is going on in the higher spheres. Hasidut then takes, okay, now take what you've seen and apply it to how you live. Apply it to how you connect to God, how you keep a mitzvah, how you view the soul, how you view yourself. So it kind of completed the circle of taking the mystical parts of Torah and applying them. So what does that mean to me? How does that change me? How does that change me as a person? How does it allow me to lose my ego? How does it allow me to become a better person? How does it allow me to connect to the divine in a deeper way? Right? Now that's probably just a very quick summary of something that probably should take, I don't know, a whole series on its own. But I just wanted to sort of give that bit of introduction because I think it gives a bit of context since we... So just talking about Kabbalah. Okay. So let's go back to the topic. Kabbalah of breathing. So what I want to do is tonight just talk about some general concepts and understand what I mean by the Kabbalah of breathing. And the next week we're going to take it even deeper by talking about the different stages of breathing and connecting that to different stages of the levels of the soul and so on and so forth. So we know that breathing today is a very popular concept, right? And so in modern mindfulness, for example, in very, very many forms of modern meditation, they create a big focus and emphasis on breathing, right? And sometimes it's done for two different reasons. One is, it's just a good way to start. It's a good way to create consciousness and awareness. So breathing is something we do all the time. Breathing is critical to the essence of life. And yet, we take it for granted. Most people wouldn't be, even if they don't think about it, they're not even aware that they're breathing. Unless they've got a cold, of course. But otherwise it just flows, right? It's a rhythm of life, and we just sort of take it for granted, and we keep breathing. And one of the ways to make people more mindful and more focused and more conscious and aware is to notice, to learn to notice that critical part of life, which is the rhythm of our breathing. So that's one purpose. But another concept we know is that not just to use breathing as a tool for calmness or for awareness or for consciousness, but actually to meditate and to reflect on the breathing itself, which is what I really want to kind of sort of focus on more tonight. So those of you who have joined some of my meditations would know that I always talk about the link between our breath and the soul, right? Which we're going to develop tonight a bit more deeply. Now, in Hebrew, of course, we know that's obvious because the word for breath in Hebrew is neshima, right? Which, of course, is the same word as soul, which is neshama. So that's an obvious connection. So where does that come from? That's nice to see that the words are similar, but normally in Hebrew, when two words meaning different things are very similar or have a similar root, they normally are connected on a deeper level. So where does it all come from? So I want to just take you through a few verses in the Torah where this actually comes from. So if you have a look at the handout, just number 2, in Bereshit, in Genesis, right? So it says that the Lord God formed man from the dust of the earth. He blew into his nostrils. Vayipach be'apav. Nishmat chayim, a breath of life, a soul of life. We use the words neshama, nishmat chayim, the soul of life. And then it says the man became a living thing, which we'll come back to later. So the neshama, the very essence of our life, the soul that keeps us alive, that divine energy which causes us to exist essentially, was given to us through our nostrils, which is the mechanism of breathing. Which therefore means that when we breathe, as the Baal Shem Tov says, and we'll soon see, we actually connect to the soul. Breathing is a form, it's a manifestation, an expression of the soul, and it's a way to connect to the soul. Now let's just focus a moment on that phrase, Vayipach, and he blew, right? So we know that Kabbalah teaches us, and this is talked about in the famous book of Tanya from the first Chabad Rebbe, that we know that one of the fundamental Jewish beliefs is that God doesn't have a physical form, but he uses expressions which we can then use, I can never pronounce this word, but anthropomorphologically or something, which gives us an insight of how to describe what is happening. So we know that the relationship between God and the rest of creation is through speech, right? Dibur. We know that the world was created through 10 utterances. Yeah. But when it comes to the soul, when he created a human being, when it comes to the soul, it doesn't use the term "and he said, let there be a soul." It says "vayipach be'apav." He said, and he blew into his nostrils a soul of life. Right. So, what's the difference between speech and blowing? Any suggestions? Sorry. Okay, that's right.
The speech comes from the brain and the blowing comes from the heart, doesn't it? Or the lungs.
The lungs, okay. Yeah.
One is more inactive and one is very active.
Right, so speech is inactive, right?
One less active.
Less active, correct. So you could, correct. Although speech is very powerful, but the actual act of speaking, distinct from communication, which we'll talk about later, but the actual act of speaking, right, is fairly passive. In other words, a person can speak and not get tired. Right? I'm sure we all know people like that, right? They talk a long time and never get tired. So, why? Because speech has a minimal level of investment. In other words, not that it's wouldn't say it's effortless. It's not effortless, but it's less effort, which means it's less. I'm giving less of me when I speak. Right? The more of me I give when I'm doing something, the tireder I will become quicker, right? I'm saying a human being will become tired, but that's just the way we work, right? The more we put into something, the more we need to rest. So it's often an indication of how much are we putting into something to how tired we become, right? So God's relationship with the world, everything is created by God, everything connects to the divine energy at the end of the day, but, and there's a spark, right? There's the Arizal explains, there's a sort of a divine spark within every creation, and it connects back to the ten spherot, as I said before, but it's a different type of relationship. It's a more distant relationship, right? I can talk, for example, and my speech can be heard in a different room. It can be a wall separating between me and the speech, one of which indicates that the speech is coming from me, but it's not in a visible way so connected to me, right? Whereas Vayipach be'apav, when God blew into the nostrils of man, blowing, in fact, this is the Zohar says this, right? I mean, you said it before, but the Zohar says it very clearly. The Zohar says, coming all the way back from the Zohar, man de'napach mitochei napach, that someone who blows from his insides, right? That's the expression used in the Zohar, blowing from the insides. So what is the soul there for? That's an important thing to understand. Now, the soul has many layers, as we'll see a little bit later, but the essence of the soul, in fact, is a spark deeply connected with God. Right? So we have within ourselves a soul, which at its essence is very deeply connected to God. If one can use that language, it's a part of God, so to speak, right? Not to be confused, we're not God, but we have within us a very deep godly energy, which God blew through the nostrils, which we connect to through our breathing. So our breath, when we breathe in and out, we are giving expression to the soul and thinking about our breath, thinking about how breathing works, which we'll talk about soon, creates a greater awareness of what's behind that breath. Through the nostrils, the neshama, the soul, which is manifesting itself through the breath. So it's interesting because that's how it works in the physical sense, right? We do lots of things to exist. We eat, we walk, we exercise, we talk, whatever, right? But the thing that's most fundamental to existence is breath. I mean, the worst thing that happens to someone is to suffocate, right? And a person can't exist very long without breath. They exist quite long without food, without drink, not infinitely, but enough time, right? So everything else in the world we can exist without for quite a long period of time, not without breath. Because breath is the expression, it's the symbolism of the essence of who we are, which is our soul, essentially. And that soul is the deep connection that we have with God, because we have that soul is not just created as any other creation through speech, which symbolizes a much more distant, inactive, as you said, sort of creation. But the soul is much more, by Yipach Ba'apav, that's God blew that soul.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Is
it too cold?
No, it
is. It's on a...
Oh, it's in a cycle?
It's like an order.
Turn it off.
No, but it's okay. I'm just going to move
it. It's okay. Look, it is getting a bit hot now.
No, it's okay. Let's
leave it
in.
That's okay. No problem. Okay, so that's... So that's one concept. Okay, now let's just go to number three. Number three is a very interesting verse from Isaiah, right? It's one of the prophecies of Tanakh, right? And he says an interesting thing there. He says, "Oh, cease to glorify me." Now, it's again like you look at a verse and you could just look at a literal meaning, but then we're going to give it to you the sort of the Kabbalistic meaning. It says, "Cease to glorify man who has only a breath." But he uses the word neshama, right? In his nostrils. For by what does he merit esteem? In other words, on a simple level, what the Isaiah is saying is, like man should know his or her own limitation. Like don't put a human on a huge pedestal because just a person with a bit of breath in the nostrils, right? That's the simple meaning. But the Kabbalah tells us that what, just first of all, it shows you that breath and nostrils, again, that linkage between breath and neshama. But in the mystical writings, it explains what he really means is that when we wake up in the morning, and this is something we're going to develop much more next week, but I want to just sort of flag it now, there's a development of the soul. There's a journey that the soul takes every single day. It starts off in the nostrils, be'apo, right? because the nostrils is the essence of the soul. It's where the soul begins. It's where the soul began in the 6 days of creation. It's where God blew into the soul, into the human being, the soul of life, right? But the mission, what Isaiah is saying is, don't praise yourself if you've got your soul only in your nostrils. The neshama be'apo, the neshama, the soul cannot only be in the nostrils. The soul has to then travel through, just like breathing. Breathing is not good enough, it's in the nose. You've got to breathe in, you've got to fill your lungs, right? In fact, we know that in today, modern sort of breathing exercises and meditation, they encourage a lot of deeper breathing, abdominal breathing and so on, right? Because that's, again, symbolic of the journey of the soul. The soul has to sort of infuse, has to influence everything about us, every part of our experience. But we'll come back to that a little bit later stage. Now, the main reference I want to say is a beautiful thing. We all heard of Psalms, right? Much of our prayers comes from Tehillim, the book of Psalms, which King David wrote. Right, that's sort of one of the most famous books of Tanakh ever written, I suppose, right? The reason that it's so famous is because much of our prayers every single day come from Tehillim, right? Come from Psalms. One of the verses that we say every single day, which is in number four, there's a part of davening, there's a part of prayers that is called Psukei Dezimra, which means the verses of praise, where we praise God, right? And we end off that whole section with this verse, the verse that's in number four. It says, I'll say it in Hebrew first, Kol ha-neshama tehalel ka haleluka. Every soul, or it could be read as the whole soul, right? But every soul should praise God. Every soul should connect. That's what it says, right? And the rabbis in the Talmud comment on that verse, and they say, what does it mean, the whole soul? And in fact, the custom when we say this verse every day is to repeat it twice, for emphasis. Kol ha-neshama talelka, right? And they say, what does it mean? They say, I'll call neshima u'neshima. Again, the connection between breath and soul. That on every breath that you take, you should praise God. Thank God. Okay? Now, what does that mean? But again, first of all, you see the connection there between neshama and neshima, right? So it's not just Hebrew word comparison. It's actually written in the Talmud. It's written in Kabbalah. That neshama and neshima are intrinsically connected. Every breath that we take, we should praise God. Now, what does that mean? It means we can explain on two levels. On a very basic level, what the Talmud is teaching us is that the power of gratitude. Now, we know that gratitude is one of the most powerful things that a human being can experience. It's good for us. It's healthy for us. There's so much research on it today. Very ancient Jewish idea that we wake up with gratitude. We say, Modeh Ani, and so on and so forth, right? But we know that gratitude, by default, naturally, the most natural part of a person is that we show gratitude for something amazing, right? Not for the little things. We normally show gratitude for big miracles, for amazing things, for a great gift, for a big windfall, or whatever the case is, right? And King David is teaching us, no, don't do that. For the little things. Don't take the little things for granted. Understand the little things are also powerful. So he says, every soul should praise God. What he really means is, kol neshima u neshima. Every breath that you take is an expression of life. Every breath that you take is so powerful. It's a gift from God. We say, I don't know how many breaths we take in a day. I'm not sure what the science of that is. But there's every breath that we take, that rhythm of breathing is an amazing gift, right? So that's what it means on one level. On another level, and this comes from the Baal Shem Tov, again, sort of the great mystic, the Baal Shem Tov. And he says the following. He says that what it means, he says, we see from this the link between the word neshama and neshima, soul and breath, right? And he says, therefore, he says, what King David is telling us is that with every breath that you take, you need to use that breath as a consciousness and awareness and a connection to your soul, right? So I like to call that Jewish mindfulness, right? So being mindful means to be aware of where you are, being aware of what you're experiencing, being aware of your being, right? So real mindfulness is, you know, is a state of being, and it's being aware of not just doing something else, but being aware of myself. When we breathe, says the Baal Shem Tov, and this, I guess, really is the topic, that every breath that we take, and when we do stop, I mean, obviously we can't do this all day, but when we take a few minutes sometimes just stop and think about our breathing and what that means to the way we live and the critical component of life experience, is every breath we take should be a mechanism through which we can be aware of our deeper side, our deeper self, right? So one can be aware of their breath and just be aware of being, so that's just a good form of simple meditation, simple reflection, where a person just stops and recognizes that they're breathing, they recognize they're alive, they have gratitude for being alive, they link in and connect to the rhythm, the calmness of breath and so on. But the Baal Shem Tov said, what King David's really trying to tell us is that every breath that we take, we should connect to the soul. It's a pathway to the soul. Going back to the very first verse that we learned, which is because the soul came through our nostrils, the soul came through God's breathing, so to speak, God's blowing, whatever that means, and on a godly level, and through our nostrils, which is the mechanism of breath. So every breath that we take, when we stop and think about our breath, what it should be doing, what we should be doing is, I call neshima un neshima, and every breath that we take, says King David, it's not just neshima, it's neshama, that we become aware of who we really are. We become aware of that soul, we become aware of what we can do with that soul, we become aware of what that soul can do for us, where it can take us, that selfless part of us, that purity of us, that we can connect to, right? We're clear so far? We're good? Okay. So what does that mean? What is the soul there for? How are we going to use the breath, so to speak, to connect to the soul, right? So first of all, before we actually discuss the soul, let me just say two more points in this. One comes from another great commentary called the Dat Sofrim, which says, when you become aware of the soul through your breath, you become aware that every experience has a soul. And therefore what that means is, he says, interesting, amazing thing, he says that everything we experience is not the same as another experience, right? So every day is different. We have good days and bad days. We have challenging times and not so challenging times, right? And so on. And there are times where we experience things that on the surface are negative, are hard, are challenging, are experiences that almost prompt us to want to question why we're alive altogether, right? And it says about Sofrim that when we use the breathing mechanism to connect to our soul, when we understand that every time we breathe, every time we experience, every time we are, every time we exist, in other words, we're really connecting to something deeper, which is the neshima, connecting to the neshama, we then start to understand and remember that everything has a deeper level, and everything has a deeper soul. And when we connect to the soul, not only our own soul, but the soul of an experience, we can learn, as challenging as sometimes this might be, we can learn to give it meaning. We can learn to give it purpose. We can grow from it. We can give it a soul. And when we give it a soul, it becomes easier to deal with, right? Now, part of how that works, and that's part of the rhythm of breath, we know that we breathe in, we inhale, and we exhale. Part of connecting to the soul, and part of connecting to what we're going to talk about, requires two things. It requires connecting to the purity of the soul, but it also means letting go, as I said before, letting go of the toxic part of who we are, right? Letting go of our ego, letting go of the baggage that we have, letting go of the things that stand in the way of our progress, of our growth, which also is manifested in the way we breathe, because we breathe in, so we're breathing in life, we're absorbing the soul, we're connecting to the soul, we're connecting to the neshama, we also breathe out, which is letting go of toxicity. So that's the rhythm of breath, also represents how that journey works, that breathing needs to be a mechanism where we connect to the soul, but it also needs to be a mechanism how we learn by connecting to the soul to let go of stuff that's interfering, right? So that's how it works. Now, what does all this mean? So what does the soul mean? What are we talking about, right? So we know that there are two. So we talked about the nostrils, right? But we know there are two primary organs of how we breathe, the nose and the mouth, right? And in fact, you know, very, 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 a lot of sort of breathing exercises, they encourage people to breathe through the nose and let go through the mouth, or the other way around. No, like that. Some do, some don't. Kabbalistically, that's the way, anyway, that's the way it is. So, but we certainly can breathe both through the nose and the mouth. They're both connected to breath. And the reason that is, and that's the beginning of the journey of the soul before it flows to the rest of the body, is because there are two aspects of the neshama, right, which we need to understand first before we can go further. Again, the breathing is the pathway to the soul. Neshima is a pathway to the neshama. There are two aspects of the neshama that we have to understand very well and connect to very well before we can take it further. The first is the purity of the soul, the divine energy aspect of the soul, the fact that the soul at its very root is a spark of godliness, it's a spark of purity, it's a spark of absolute purity which can never be corrupted, and it's that very foundation and purity of our soul which allows us to discover meaning and purpose in life. It's the part of us that inspires us to seek meaning, to seek something higher, to seek godliness, to seek purpose. That's the first part of the soul, the first aspect of the soul. And the second aspect of the soul is what I call the infinity of the soul, meaning we're not infinite people because only God is infinite, but there's an aspect of infinity which allows us to go beyond ourselves, right? In other words, not to be limited by ourselves. That's real growth. Real growth doesn't only mean, as we said before, to become spiritual, but still remain within who I am. But really letting go of ego and connecting to the soul actually means to actually really go beyond who we are. And that's a very important aspect of the soul. We see how we see that in the two sources of breath. Okay. So let's talk about the nose first of all. Right? So the nose is the limb where we use the scent, we have the sense of smell, right? Now, what's that got to do with the soul? So we know that a person has what we call the five senses, right? Kabbalah talks about this a lot. The five senses, the sense of smell, taste, touch, sight, and hearing, right? Kabbalistically, these five senses of the soul, of the five senses of the human being, correspond to five layers of the soul. Okay? Because actually, and we'll talk about this more next week, the soul actually has five layers, five madrigot, five manifestations. In Kabbalah language, it's called nefesh, ruach, neshama, chaya, and yechida. Essentially, just to explain what they are very, very briefly, the different parts of the human experience is connected to different parts of the soul. So the outer layer of the soul is the behavior, called the nefesh. Then ruach is the emotions, and neshama is the intellect, chaya is the subconscious, and yechida is the point of the soul, the real essence of the soul, right? Now, we find a fascinating thing with the five senses. And this actually goes back to one of the first stories in Genesis, right? Where we have the sin of the fruit. So God creates Adam and Eve, tells them not to eat from the fruit, and they sin, right? Starts with the snake coming to Eve, looking at the fruit, it's very tasty. She succumbs, she takes the fruit, she eats it, she gives it to her husband, he eats it, and it's all downhill from there, right? Okay, so you will notice, if you look in the verses there, a fascinating thing. You will notice mention of four out of the five senses. They saw the fruit, they heard God's voice, they took the fruit, they ate the fruit, right? Four out of the five senses. The one that's missing there is the sense of smell. You don't find that there. Why? Because we find with most people, I'm talking about healthy human beings, I'm not talking about when people suffer from deep addictions and so on, but healthy human beings are normally tempted. We have our challenges and we get tempted on four out of the five senses, right? We take things we shouldn't take, we touch things we shouldn't touch, we do things we shouldn't do. We hear things we shouldn't hear. We're tempted to hear gossip sometimes. We're tempted to find things out that we shouldn't hear. We believe things that are dishonest, whatever, all that kind of stuff, right? We say things we shouldn't say. We eat things we shouldn't eat. The mouth can be very powerful, right? We can kill people with our tongue. I mean, it's a very, very powerful thing. All these things can be used for tremendous good, but they can also be used for tremendous bad, and there's a struggle, right? There's a challenge. And people can fail or succeed either one. So you can succeed or fail in hearing, in seeing, in tasting, in taking, in touching, and so on. Most healthy people are not overly tempted when it comes to smell. I mean, we use smell and think that smell nice, very good, but no one's got like a We don't find out about a major challenge as well, right? That's interesting. It's an interesting physical phenomenon, which, right? Sorry?
Makes you run away from something.
Yeah, no, it might. I mean, a bad spell. You're right, correct. But that's like, you know, you do that. It's not like you, no one like has got a terrible challenge that they like to, I don't know, whatever.
Just the, you know. Chocolate and coffee.
It was more eating them than or drinking them than smelling them. Yeah, you smell it first, but there's no like, the temptation's not in the smelling, right? You don't become unhealthy from smelling it. You become unhealthy from eating it or drinking it. Too much of it anyways. But there's a deep Kabbalistic meaning, reason for that, and that is because these physical senses actually reflect a spiritual part of the soul. And we, on the four outer layers of the soul, we can actually fail, right? We can damage our soul. We can repair it, but we can damage our soul. We can damage our behavior. We can damage our emotions. We can have unhealthy emotions, toxic emotions, negative emotions. We can have distorted thinking. And we can even damage our subconscious in many, many ways. I mean, in the modern world, we know that subliminal advertising has a tremendous effect on subconscious. There are things when we don't deal with things properly, relationship issues, hate, resentment, that they sink into the recesses of our subconscious and they sometimes surface in a very unhealthy way. We can be damaged on all these different layers, right? Except for smell. So four out of five layers of the soul can be damaged and can be damaged badly or they can succeed, right? What can never be damaged, what is always intact, what is always pure, what is always pristine, is the fifth layer of the soul, the core spark of the soul, the essence of the soul. That original blowing that God blew into through our nostrils, the nose, the breathing, that's absolutely pure. And that's an amazingly empowering thought, because what that means is no matter how much we fail or damage ourselves, we never ever kill the root of the soul. Never. And there's always that intrinsic value, that intrinsic good, which is sometimes very hidden, but it's there. It's there inspiring us, hopefully, if we connect to it, if we think about it, if we realize it, if we're aware of it, if we're conscious of it, if we acknowledge it. It's there propelling us back into a repair and rebuild mode for the other levels of the soul through remembering that we're always intact, we're always connected. We never become disconnected. We've always got that intrinsic. And that's the beginning, that's where the soul begins, through the mechanism of breath, through the nose, the limb of aroma, the limb of fragrance. And that's where it lies, that essence of the soul, that deep meaning of the soul, right? You know, Viktor Frankl, in his writings, which is very in line with Jewish thinking, talks about that every single human being has a spark. He calls it a spark, he doesn't call it a soul, but he was Jewish actually, but he says every human being has a spark at the very essence of their being that desires meaning, that desires purpose. Hence his theory of logotherapy, which is man's search for meaning, right? And he says, and if you don't feed it, it breeds unhappiness at the end of the day. But it's always there. You never lose it. Right, so you can always come back to it, because he says that's what it is, because it's a spark of godliness. I mean, he doesn't say that, but that's the reason for it, right? The reason that there's that spark at the depth of the human experience, which searches for meaning, is because it's that spark of godliness, that godly spark, and that doesn't become corrupted. The manifestations of it do, the other layers of the soul do, but the smell of the soul through the nose, that organ of breath, never becomes corrupted. Just interesting, because with this time of the year, I just mentioned this. In just under 2 weeks, we're going to celebrate the festival of Purim, right? The festival of Purim is very much connected with this concept, because we are taught that the festival of Purim was all about the Jewish nation sunk into a very, very dark space. The time of the Purim story was a very dark time, a time of exile, a time that God was completely hidden, right? In fact, in the book of the Megillah, you don't even find God's name. God's name, by the way, is four letters, right? Again, the four and the fifth. So, and the story of Purim was that although the Jews seemed completely desperate and doomed, they were completely doomed for destruction. At the last moment, they became re-inspired and reconnected. Why? Because what was Purim? Purim was about reconnecting to the essence of the soul. The reason I mention that is because Esther, the heroine of Purim, had two names, the Megillah tells us. Esther, he Hadassah, her other name was Hadassah. Hadassah is a myrtle branch. We take on Sukkot, right? myrtle branch has a nice smell. So the concept of smell. And Mordechai, the Talmud tells us, the word Mordechai comes from a phrase in the Torah, Mara Dachya, which is one of the spices used in the temple to create the anointing oil. So the two names, the two heroes of Purim, Mordechai and Esther, are connected with this concept of sense of smell, which is the essence of the soul, the nose. Right? Okay. That's the one thing. Now, the other organ of the soul, of breathing, is the mouth. Now, just got to number five for a second. I want to show you something very fascinating. When it says that God blew into the nostril the soul of life, right, through the pathways of breath, it says, "Vayhi Adam nefesh chaya," and man became a living thing. Man became a living thing. Now, we have a very famous, the very first translation of Chumash of the Torah was not the Sansina or the article, but it was in the times of the Talmud. It was written by one of the greatest Talmudic sages called Uncalus, who was a very righteous person. He wrote it quite prophetically. He didn't just translate. He actually put in deep, deep mystical insights into his little translation. The translation is this: Aramaic, the language that was spoken around his time, and it's printed in most Chumashim, actually. He has a very weird translation on this verse, that man became a living thing, which in Hebrew is Vayhi Adam Nefesh Chaya. Man became a living thing. He translates it as, and the person became Ruach Memalala, a speaking spirit. A communicator. Right? In some of the, I think it's the Arizal who says, Hanefesh Melea Otiyot. The depth of the soul is filled with words. Right? Words which you speak through the mouth. Again, the other mechanism of breath, right? The Talmud talks about this, that the world is divided into four things, four types of creations. There's domem, which is the inanimate, like rocks and minerals and so on. There's tzomeach, there's things that grow. There's chai, the animal kingdom. Then there's the human being. How's the human being defined? A speaker, communicator, medaber. The human being is called the medaber, not Adam or Ish or Enosh. Right, the way we define human being is medaber, the speaker. Why is that? Why are we defined by communication? So, true communication, and again, communication is a long subject in its own right, but true communication is not just speaking words, right? Because we know that animals communicate too. We are taught in the Talmud that King Solomon was able to understand the language of the birds and the language of the animals. So why does a person call the communicator, right? And the reason for that is because there's a fundamental difference between human communication and animal communication. The challenge, of course, is that what we speak is to make sure that we're using human communication as opposed to animal communication. I'll explain what that means in a moment, right? But when we communicate, what does real communication mean? It doesn't mean, see, an animal communicates, it sends signals. So an animal will send a signal, a broadcast a signal. I'm hungry, I'm going to attack, I'm scared, right? And another animal in the vicinity will pick up on it. So that's signal sending, right? But that's not communication. I mean, that's the way a lot of people talk, unfortunately. They just broadcast signals because they're broadcasting themselves, right? In other words, sometimes people talk, I'll give you an example. I mean, I hope I'm not doing this now, but have you ever gone to a wedding or something and someone gets up to make a speech, goes on and on and on, the entire crowd is completely bored, and the person has no idea, right? No idea that anyone is completely not listening. No one's listening, right? What's the person doing? Just broadcasting. Not talking to the other person, they're just broadcasting. Communication means the ability to leave myself and to enter the world of another. That's what real communication is. Real speaking is the ability to say something where you understand the other person's world. Now, an animal can't do that. The reason an animal can't do that is because an animal can't exit its own world. Because every creation that was created by God is created with a certain definition and is locked into that definition. The Only one that is able to do that is a human being. Human being is able to leave themselves. If you think about it, it's a very, very powerful thing. To leave themselves. Why? In other words, I can have a perspective, I can understand. And part of talking, by the way, is listening, of course. But I have the ability, it doesn't mean I always do it, but I have the ability to listen to someone, to understand their world, which is radically different from my world, to leave my world and to say something that will make sense in their world. Is this making sense? Yeah. Just want to make sure I'm not signal sending here. Right? Yeah. That's an amazing ability, right? Which is why all relationships come through communication. Because that's the power of relationships, human relationships. The power of relationships is the ability to connect to someone else's world. Which, by the way, comes from listening. Which is why in the Ethics of the Fathers was a great sage that said that Kol Yamai, my whole life, I grew up among the sages and I realized there's nothing better than silence. And the commentaries say, hold on a second, we just said the human being is called the communicator. Right? Why should the best thing be silence? But of course he didn't mean silence never to speak. He meant silence as listening. The first step to communication is listening. Because you've got to understand the other person's world before you can speak to it. Right? Now, this is a long discussion, it's all right. The reason I'm bringing it in is because this goes to the heart of what the soul is. Because the soul is, again, the soul is vayipach papav. God blew into the nostrils, God blew into us a fusion of life coming from Him. God is infinite. God is pure and God is infinite. So what He did was He gave into us the ability to go beyond ourselves. And that's why the translation says the person became a living being means became a speaking spirit. But He gave us the gift of communication, the gift of words. Right? The gift of words. Because to really be human means to lose our ego, to lose ourselves, and to connect to something other than ourselves. Firstly, other relationships, and ultimately, not only relationships with other human beings, but a relationship with God. Right? You know that the imagery, when God gave the Torah, the imagery is not just one of commandments, it's the imagery of a wedding, of a relationship. Because God gave us that ability to make room for something higher, a higher purpose, a higher being, a higher pursuit, other than just our own interest, our own self. Right? So that's why the other mechanism of breath is through the mouth. Because it's the mouth which we use to communicate. And since the breath is the expression of our soul, it's these two parts of the soul that we need to understand before we can take it further. Is that the soul at its essence has a core spark of purity, which is never damaged. That's the smell, the fragrance, which is never damaged. It's that fifth level, that essential level. And also it's the soul that gives us the ability to go beyond ourselves, gives us a sense of infinity. It's a very empowering thing. In other words, it tells us that we're not stuck and we can't be stuck. We're not bound by our personality. You know, the Talmud says that all sorts of things that shape a human being. What's that? You know, there's all sorts of things that shape a human being, right? There's like, you know, the famous debate, nature, nurture, and so on, right? You know that it's true. In fact, they're both true. The Talmud goes through it. The Talmud talks about the day of the week that you're born in and the hour that you're born in and what planet you're influenced by and your parents and your environment and your friends. Everything. All true. What's its relevance? The relevance is that it's all true and we're bound by none of it. Why? Because we can make a choice to be who we are not. No other creation can do that. We can. Why? Because we have a soul. And that soul has a spark of infinity. Where's that infinity most revealed and expressed? Communication. That's why the neshama, God blew from his own nostrils, He blew into us. It's a spirit of, it became a speaking spirit. A communicator. That's why we call the communicator. Communicator doesn't always mean through words. It means connector. Connected to something other than ourself. Which is, I mean, if you can only live this, it'd be amazing, right? But it means, that's step one, to be aware of this, that we don't need to be stuck. Now, I mentioned Purim. What's interesting is that we're coming up after Purim. I don't want to scare anyone, but after Purim, there's Pesach, right? I know some people don't like when you say that, but they call it the P word, you know? Like, right? After Purim comes Pesach, right? So Pesach is when the Jews were given the gift of freedom, right? What is the gift of freedom? Freedom means not to do what we want. Freedom means the ability to choose, ability to go beyond ourselves, ability not to be intrinsically and spiritually stuck. Kabbalah tells us that the word Pesach comes from two words, Pesach, a mouth that speaks. Again, because Pesach is about freedom, intrinsic freedom. Freedom means to connect beyond ourselves, to go beyond our ego, to make room for others, other things, other beings, God, and so on. Freedom means to not be bound by our personality, not be bound by our temptations, not be bound by the things that hold us back. Right? If you've read recently the I gave a series on it called The Choice by Edith Eger. She talks a lot about this, of course. Right? But it's an ancient Jewish idea, of course, which comes from the root of the soul. It expresses itself in the intellect, by the way, because we use our brain to make decisions, but it doesn't come from the brain, because we can think distorted thoughts as well. And a lot of people rationalize very terrible imprisoning behavior and trap behavior. Right? So it doesn't come, it's the tool is the brain, but its source is the soul, the ability to be free. So what's interesting is that if you look in the Chumash, and we're going to deal with this in detail next week, when Moses came to tell the Jewish people that they're going to be revealed, they're going to be redeemed from Egypt, it said, "V'lo shamu el Moshe." They didn't listen to Moses. Why? Mikotzer ruach, because of shortness of breath, and from hard work. Right? So you can see the connection there. Shortness of breath. Their breath was not functioning properly. They weren't in touch with their soul. I mean, it literally means they were just tired, right? But the language that the Torah uses is mekotzer ruach, from shortness of breath. Because they weren't connecting to their breath properly. They weren't connecting to their soul properly. It was only once they were redeemed from Egypt that were given that soul, that mechanism to connect to that soul properly, and therefore to be free, to connect higher, to connect the other. So the first two foundations of this concept is to understand that these two parts of our body which we use for breathing, which is the mouth and the nose, is manifest these two fundamental principles about the neshama. The neshima connects to the neshama, and it allows us to understand the basis of who we really are, and that is that we have that spark of purity, which is at the foundation of our being always, and therefore we never are lost, we're never beyond hope. That can never ever happen, because we always have that spark that is always there, because it's a godly spark. It's a spark which is connected to the nose, it's a spark which is connected to the concept of fragrance, that sense that can never be corrupted, and that the mouth is the symbol of communication, because the soul made us into a communicator, a connector, the ability to go beyond ourselves, to connect higher than ourselves. Now, we started off, and we'll end with this before we sort of practice this a bit. We started off by that verse in Isaiah that says that a person shouldn't leave the soul in the nostrils, right? It says at the beginning of the day, the neshama be'apo, the neshama is in the nostrils. Now the problem is when the neshama remains in the nostrils and doesn't travel. And that will develop next week about the different stages of breathing and what that means to the different stages of the soul, and how that sort of gives us the strategies of how to actually infuse the rest of life's experiences with the concept of breathing, through which we can remind ourselves and become conscious of the workings and the levels and the layers of the neshama, the neshima and neshama relationship. But for now, maybe let's spend a few minutes, if we can, just trying to internalize this a little bit. So I invite you just to join me in a few minutes of meditation. Let's try and internalize this. It's always good to think about it and reflect it. So whichever way you want, if you want to get yourself into a bit of a comfortable spot, whatever's comfortable for you, just calmly and just relaxed, and when you're ready, just slowly close your eyes. In a relaxed way, just try and turn your attention to your breathing. Become aware, just take notice. Notice your breath, breathing in and out. Just Stay focused on that for a few moments. Just try to remain aware and try to feel every inhalation and every exhalation. If your mind wanders, just gently and non-judgmentally, just bring it back and to the present moment, to your breathing, and just become aware as you breathe in and out. As we continue to notice our breath, let's try and go a bit deeper and remember that the neshima, our breath, is the pathway to the neshama, our soul. Every breath that we take is a manifestation of the godly spark within us, the purity of our soul. Think about that for a few moments as you continue to inhale and exhale. Our breath and our soul is the essence of who we are. It's the pure spark of godliness. God blew through our nostrils. Kol neshima u'neshima, every breath that we take, we connect to the essence of who we are. And neshama, the deep purity of our soul, the intrinsic value of our neshama, the infinity of our neshama. Our neshima is the pulse of life, and neshama is our core identity. What defines us is not what we do, but it's who we are. That godly spark, that purity. Try to notice as you breathe in, think about absorbing and connecting to the soul. As you breathe out, try to feel the letting go of the toxicity, the negativity, that which stands in the way of our soul. Just think about that for a few moments. Neshama is the source of our freedom, it's the source of our growth. It allows us to go beyond who we are, to connect higher, to connect deeper. When I breathe, I remember who I really am. Every neshima connects me with my neshama. Just feel the rhythm of the inhalation and exhalation and the calmness that comes with the rhythm of the breath, which connects to the purity of the soul. Every so often when things unravel, we just need to stop, take a few breaths, and through the neshima, just remember and connect to our neshama. Hold that thought, and when you're ready, just slowly open your eyes, just come back to where we are. And just let's try and remember that this is it's a tool. It's a real, what I call, Jewish mindfulness tool. It's not just about calming down or releasing stress. It's about connecting to the essence of who we really are. So as we go through each day, we do many things. We can't always think about our breathing. That would be a bit obsessive. But every so often, we do. When we pray, wake up in the morning, one of the things we know, wake up in the morning, there's a prayer called Modeh Ani, where we thank God for being alive and being able to breathe and for the soul that He gave us. And once in a while, we just need to stop, even if it's for a few moments, and just inhale and exhale and remember what that represents. Kol Neshima. Every breath represents the soul, like the Baal Shem Tov said. And that's the foundation of Kabbalah breathing. But next week, as I said, we're going to take it a lot deeper and actually break it down, the different segments of breathing and what that means in terms of different parts of our functionality and our soul and our experience and how it all connects. So thanks for coming. And have a great week, everyone.